but it didn't bother me right on the surface.
Think of it as Miller-esque.
Okay, Miller-esque. Okay.
Consumer garbage tax, I guess. I think we better move on to another witness here. We can always throw rocks at Mike from time to time on this issue. Someone else wish to testify here who has not previously testified?
Not if he's not located in the last.
Yes, this gentleman was saying he wanted to testify a while back. Did you join us, sir? Yes, just come up here, please.
The guy's located in Seattle. We can force him to figure out.
He's also loaded an Yankee.
Well, I heard you before. I heard anybody else here about 20 minutes ago.
I'll have to check that out. See how it worked either way, but I think we've adjusted to the density.
My name's Robert L. Garrison, Mr. Chairman.
Robert L. Garrison?
Garrison, right. I'm chairman of Project Pride. Project Pride was created by a resolution of the city borough of Juneau. And the function of Project Pride is to try to instill a little pride in our community and hoping to make it a cleaner and more beautiful place to live. And as a result of this has been in effect since 1974, December 19th, 1974. But prior to that, I've probably spent the last 10 or 12 years involved in the, I can't tell you the exact number of years, but too long involved in the cleanup campaign in Juneau in the spring. And we've come to the conclusion that our method is not working. That we need some other means of accomplishing this. And I'm not saying this bottle bill is the ultimate answer, but I would hope that it would help anyhow if it were to pass. And I have to say that I don't necessarily agree with all the various and sundry percentages that I've heard, because it's been my experience over the years that a majority of our litter is the bottles and cans along the highway. And I suppose you could, depending on whether you were on the lee or windward side, as to how many pieces of paper you picked up and how many cans you picked up. And it's also my understanding that Rainier did lose money in Juneau returning bottles at a cent apiece. So I realize there are problems. But I think I've been over every highway in the state except the Stees Highway. And we certainly have a litter problem as far as the bottles and cans are concerned throughout the whole state.
Try the Stees on the 4th of July weekend. It's no different.
But that's one I've missed so far, I guess. I feel we're kind of on a treadmill. We are educating people, and we are getting a response, but unfortunately our population is increasing, and so we're just really on a treadmill. We're not really gaining anything with, even though we are educating. And I will have to admit that out on the water here this past summer, we were very fortunate. It did decrease, but it decreased because there was a convenient container right at the boat launch ramps and at each one of the boat harbors. So, but beyond that, why, along the roads, we just haven't gained a thing. And I still say that a big percentage is because of the bottles and cans. And I'd like to point out that Mr. Fox, Tom Cox, it was last Friday, in his testimony, when he stated how much they picked up at this one particular time in Anchorage, they gave away 50 bicycles and 18,000 Pepsi and Coca-Cola drinks free. And of course, you take smaller communities, it's pretty hard to get out that kind of a project. We're just not financially capable of doing it on that scale, although we have given bicycles away here in the past and things.
What did they do with the 18,000 bottles of cans?
I don't know, but I do have the clipping. I do maintain a little clipping of my own throughout whenever I can, and I do have the clipping out of the Anchorage News, although it isn't dated.
Well, why don't we ask the staff to make a Xerox of that clipping and put it in the...
And we have gone out, here I have clippings of from the local paper, where we've gone out, like to Windfall Lake, and I don't know how many people have ever been to Windfall Lake. I'm sorry that's not dated, but it is the year that he referred to. And we've picked up bottles, and even here is a picture of a man out raking the cans and the bottles out of the lake as far as he could get out in his waders. Now, we actually, it was just almost covered, the lake bottom, with cans and bottles. And in this particular case, there happened to be some holes. We buried the older ones, and we smashed the others and packed them back, and they were... Practically every one of them was a tin can, and we packed them back on 5 pack boards out from Windfall Lake, and that's generally my testimony.
Well, I'm reminded that there was a television program on public broadcasting, I think it's still on, called Gene Shepherd's America, in which a crazy comedian announcer from WOR Radio in New York was traveling all over the country, and he went into a long monologue on the North Slope of Alaska, thinking about how isn't it excellent and wonderful that here I am on the edge of civilization, perhaps where I'm standing right now, not one other man has stood, and he went on and on for about 5 minutes, and then the camera panned down at his feet, and there was an Olympia beer bottle with the Arctic Ocean in the background. Mr. Chatterton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, your Project Pride, is it voluntary?
Yes.
It's okay. Well, now, I don't think there's anyone in this room that does not agree that we have a litter problem. And the only thing that's bothering the heck out of me is, why don't we go right to the problem of litter rather than this indirect approach as is being proposed here by this legislation?
Well, I believe we actually have, we have made an effort in that vein, I'm sure the borough right at the present time spends a disproportionate amount of time, effort, and money, and it's still a lost cause. We still have those cans and bottles it's my experience that if you were to play the percentage game, I would say a good 75% is the bottles and cans. Now, as far as the tires and things, we've picked up very few tires and hubcaps and things of this nature. There's just not all that amount.
But if there were funding for crews to go out and pick this litter up, why, do you think that you could keep the borough, General Douglas borough, clean?
I would hate to have to pay for it, I'll tell you, when you consider the time and effort that our group has put in on it.
You'd rather have the consumer of the litter, in effect, pay for it.
Well, I would hope that can and bottle were worth enough that some way or other that it would get returned.
Well, we would hope, but we don't always get our hopes.
I realize.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Glover?
My name is Richard D. Glover. I represent the United States Brewers Association. I think that I preface my testimony by saying that I feel that this bill is... addresses the right problem, but it has the wrong solution to the problem.
Before you continue, Mr. Lauber, can I ask, just for reference, who are examples of the members of the U.S. Brewers Association?
Well, every major brewery in the United States, I would assume, would be a fair example. I haven't heard mention of any that are not. At the present time, the brewery in Alaska, however, is not a member of the United States Brewers Association.
I believe that
Lucky Lager is the only major brewery that is not a member.
Okay, continue, Mr. Roberts.
There was some reference made last Friday to an approach that was used in the state of Washington, and it somewhat distresses me that this committee or some legislative group could not pay some more attention to that solution. The two states, Oregon and Washington, side by side, have attacked the problem of litter from a separate method. The Oregon bill, as you know, and we're basically studying an Oregon bill here, attacks the litter problem of beverage containers. And there's no doubt but what the Oregon method has reduced litter, roadside litter from beverage containers. We can argue what is the major part of litter. I would hope that the committee would obtain the two studies that were made. I believe Mr. Lloyd Haynes was going to supply you with those that information. I don't know if he did or not, but I would like to at this time. The Oregon study was done in 1974 by the Applied Decision System, ADS, of Wesley Hills, Massachusetts. This is a research firm which was under contract by the state of Oregon, and it was selected jointly by the governor's office of Oregon and the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. The Washington study was the URS company of Seattle, Washington. The study was done in October of 1976. The URS company was under contract with the Washington Department of Ecology. URS apparently is a national organization in engineering, environmental sciences, research, and related fields. The two studies, and I'll just cover them briefly, and I have not seen copies of them, and I certainly would. I hope that this committee would be able to obtain copies, because I can't tell you how they assessed litter. In other words, I don't think that they counted leaves and twigs, but and I don't know whether they weighted or whether it was by volume or number or what. But they were a little bit different. The Oregon study counted beverage-related containers, where the Washington study counted metal and glass, and I assume that the vast majority of the metal and glass was beverage containers. They both have been in effect, the two plans, for about the same length of time. And we've heard some testimony about the total litter in Oregon has been reduced by 10.6%, while the Washington total litter, and however they count it, was down 66%. Each year, the Washington litter has decreased. It went, I think, the first year maybe 50%, and then 55%, then 60%, and then last year 66%. But I think one of the interesting points is that, now taking the two studies, in the state of Oregon, the total reduction of beverage-related litter was down 67%. Undoubtedly, a major reduction in containers. However, the Washington metal and glass, most of it, of course, being beverage containers, is down 71%. A better record in presumably beverage containers than the Oregon type legislation. I would also like to call your attention to the obvious that Oregon is Oregon, and we're not talking about Oregon. We have, I think by the testimony of other witnesses, indicated that we have some unique problems here, and possibly we should look at modifications of either law. And of course this bill has attempted to do that by excluding certain areas, at least at the present time. I'd like to call attention to the fact that there is nothing in the present law to keep a community, a borough or a city, from imposing their own Oregon-type bill if they'd like to. Some of you may recall that a few years ago, in the city of Juneau, there was an effort to adopt an Oregon-type law, a deposit law. This was voted down 2-1 by enacting this law. You would be imposing on all of those communities, not excluded, something that, at least in any place that has held an election, two out of three people did not want. Now, I don't know what would happen today if there was an election, but that's the most recent, and to my knowledge, the only one held in Alaska. But if Juneau should care to go into one now, there's nothing to keep them from doing so. But you would be imposing on Wrangell and on Pelican and Petersburg and Ketchikan and every other community something that they can do by themselves right now if they would like to. The bill also mentions flip-tops, and I understand that there's efforts being made, and there are certain flip-tops alternatives where you can't pull them loose and throw them away being tested at the present time, and some of them are quite successful, some of them aren't. Many of them that are in use now are objectionable because you use your hands in order to open them. Oh, that's ridiculous, obviously use your hands. I mean, you actually put your finger on the same place where you're going to put your mouth. And this is supposedly unsanitary, obviously. There is one that I've heard about, but I have never seen, that cannot be detached, but you do not actually place your fingers on the mouth opening. Now, these are being tested, and I'm told that they feel that they should be perfected hopefully within a year and certainly within 2 years. Before you enact the flip-top thing, I think that there should be some information obtained as to when we're going to have an acceptable alternative to the present detachable flip-top. The bill, I think, not only has the right problem and the wrong solution, in a way is putting the cart before the horse, because, as you will note, it provides for a study to be made after the fact as to the economic impact and the problems that the bill would create. I would suggest that some type of a study be made before the implementation of the act. There's a lot of unanswered questions. We have had testimony from retailers, wholesalers, grocers, liquor stores, and I think we can agree upon two things. One, we have a litter problem, and also I think we can agree that this bill is going to cause some degree of problems, and I think we should know to what extent the problems are, and also I would hope that you would seriously look into the methods that not only the state of Oregon has attacked the problem, but the way that the state of Washington has attacked the problem. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, in response to what Mr. Lauber just said, I might want to mention that when I was in Washington last week, I happened to catch on TV a brief demonstration of what Coca-Cola Company has just developed in terms of this flip-top can where the tab does not come off. It, apparently, what I saw on TV,
it pushes
it
back down.
No,
here,
this
it?
One, he pulled it back. It just didn't peel off completely. It did not push down. And it was, the way they announced it on the TV broadcast, it was successful. Now, I don't know. That was only last week. The second thing I was going to ask is, Mr. Lauber, what basically, in a few sentences, what method is the state of Washington using? Do you know?
I'm certainly not an expert on either one, but I understand that it's a multi-pronged of effect. One, it's education. They have they have a lot of receptacles. Apparently, they're just about every place. And they apparently have found that, if they have a receptacle, along with their education and along with penalties for littering, by the way, interestingly enough, they reduced their penalties, not increased their penalties. Their maximum fine is $10. They apparently give out literally hundreds, if not thousands, literally. Of citations.
I just wondered about that. Yeah.
Pardon?
Literally. Sorry. Anyway, go ahead.
Literally.
Yeah, you made a joke.
Well,
they hand them out like that.
Apparently so, and they have very few court fights over it. People just go in and pay their $10. I think it's $10 is the maximum, and $10 is the minimum. And they also, the way they're funded is through a tax on all litter-producing items, certainly beverage containers, but everything. Now, that's not true, but most everything that would be litter producing. The tax is relatively small, but is borne on all levels. It's a multiple tax. So even though it is small, it's really a triple taxation. It's on the manufacturer, on the distributor, and on the wholesaler, and on the retailer. So they each pay it at every level. They also use the money to hire people to pick up litter at campsites and along the roads and so forth. This is an ongoing thing, apparently all year. This was a rough idea how they do it, and apparently it works. I recognize that we've had, Keep America Beautiful and Clean Up, Fix Up, and types of things that we have here and in Anchorage and so forth, and these are all very good, but apparently they are not the answer to the problem. Washington approached it similarly, but a little bit different on a massive approach, and apparently theirs is working. At least I think there's an indication it certainly might be, and I would suggest that it might be something that we would like to look into, particularly because of the unique problems that Alaska has if, in fact, it does adopt the Oregon-type bill.
What were you implying about the fines there in Washington? That is, you said something about they reduced the fines. Is that along what argument, that if they're reduced and they're lower, then they're more likely to be enforced rather than being unreasonably high and then not enforced at all, or what?
I don't know what their theory was, but I think that's probably it. In the some 8 years that I was on the bench, I can only recall them bringing in maybe three or four littering type cases, and most of those were serious littering problems where somebody was actually dumping their garbage on somebody's lot or something of that sort. But very seldom, and I'll bet it's the same today, do you see anybody cited for throwing a pop can or bottle out of their window. And I think that they, I don't know, maybe it's the police officers don't figure it's worth $100 or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I have to go over to the state, so thanks for letting me ask the first question. Mr. Lauber, on this percentile to the manufacturers, and then it the manufacturer has to pay an incremental tax, and distributor, and then the wholesaler, and then the retailer. Do they internalize those, or is that passed on to the consumer?
Well, I think it's so small that I think that it's probably absorbed by the company. The tax is only $150 per million. I guess you could say that eventually everything goes to the consumer, but it would, you could hardly, at that price, you could hardly increase the cost 1 cent a can or something. That would, I think that you would find it would be borne by the store or the distributor or the...
And why are they so benevolent?
I think the reason is what you're hearing today. When I first heard this, I asked the same question. I said, how would a grocery store, why would a grocery store put a tax on themselves when they could pass it along, the deposit along to the consumer? And the answer I got was that they're so happy not to have these bottles coming back that they're willing to pay it on all litter. You'll recall that the gentleman that has grocery stores in Sitka and Ketchikan proposed the same law Friday, or this, that we use that method here. So I don't know if he can speak for the whole industry, but at least that one person went that route.
Well, I think if I could just interject, you know, my own opinion, I think that everybody is proposing the Washington law as opposed to this.
Pardon?
I said I think he was representative. I mean, as far as large, sophisticated interests that have come before the committee in the last, you know, two hearings up until now, all have proposed to. That if we're going to adopt anything, we adopt the Washington law.
Have you determined whether the large sophisticated interests are wearing white hats, black hats, or gray hats?
I'm trying not to get into that. Sure.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman. Sir, I have been told that the litter, Washington State litter fund that is developed from these taxes and these fines is a growing fund. Can you shed any light on that? Is that a fact?
Yes, I understand it is. It has been growing every year. I assume that one reason for it is the inflation, as well as I think probably the state of Washington is a growing state too. But as the price goes up of items, so the tax goes up, and on all levels. My recollection is that they also have a surplus,
that's
a little
what
surplus,
I would refer
and
to a surplus.
But that's not the idea. It's not a. It's not to make money. They'll try to spend it, but they just didn't this year. They had more than they budgeted for.
That is my point. If what indeed I have been told is correct, why the state of Washington can even spend more money for litter cleanup than they actually are doing now.
Well, one of the things that apparently it would do is the tax would, I would assume, replace what we're presently doing. We must be paying somebody, this letter that Representative Specking had, the states or somebody is paying right now out of funds without any specific tax on litter producing items to have the roads cleaned up. Parks, I know they're doing that in our parks and this type of thing. This supposedly would create a fund where we could pick up that cost. At the present time, the taxpayers are paying it. And by the way, we wouldn't have as much litter under the Oregon bill, but according to that study that they did, their beverage related was down 67%. That would mean that somebody is still going to have to patrol those roads and pick up the other one-third that is not being taken back to the store. Now, by the way, it eventually, in Oregon, I guess, goes back to the store because the people that pick it up then take it back. But if you didn't do that, you wouldn't have your 90% return because, according to their study in the state of Oregon, before they pick it up, their beverage-related litter was down 67%, according to their own study.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Washington was down, by their study, 71% in glass and metal.
Just before Mr. Carpenter asks a question, I'd like to ask, if we had something like, if we attempted to do something like a Washington law, would that be a dedicated fund? Would be unconstitutional?
Well, I don't know as it would have to be a dedicated fund.
Just, I'm saying, but would that be, just that device as used in Washington, if you know, would that be
well, our Constitution prohibits dedicated funds, and so unless the Constitution was changed, I don't think we could put it into a specific fund, unless it was a voluntary thing. I'm not suggesting that, but I don't see any reason why we couldn't have a tax. We've sure got a lot of them right now that aren't dedicated, but everybody sure keeps their finger on where that money's being spent and paying its own way and so forth.
The industry must be wearing either its white or its gray hats today because it's advocating a tax. Mr. Carpenter?
Well, I don't think that that's particularly true. We don't have any hat on in here. Well, I said we have a problem.
It's rather unusual for people to come in and say, well, why don't you tax us in this manner? You see, it doesn't happen every day.
Richard, the Washington bill gets at, the Washington Litter Control Act gets at litter, but the Oregon bill gets at litter and waste. Isn't that a true statement?
The Oregon bill gets at litter and waste? Mm-hmm. No, the Oregon bill gets at beverage containers, period. The Washington bill apparently attacks the total litter problem.
That's not what I'm asking, though. I recognize the distinction.
You're talking energy?
Yes, waste. I'm talking about the Oregon bill. You're segregating the aluminum in the return, and you're bringing back bottles for the purpose of refilling them and so forth. And you're picking up on two concepts, concept of litter and concept of waste, whereas although I recognize the Washington bill is more comprehensive in its litter, how it addresses litter, it does not address waste. You just put out more receptacles to get rid of more litter, but you don't motivate any the reusable features and the recycling features of the Oregon bill.
Yes and no. Now, I don't know as it would apply in the state of Alaska, but my recollection is that the Washington bill has a recycling component in it. I'm not sure of this, but I believe that there, along with their educational process, there is an effort to segregate at least aluminum from other items, and then this is recycled. Don't hold me to that, but I seem to recall that. I've actually honestly never read the Washington bill, but I just have some throwaway material on it. I think the savings in energy, while certainly an admirable one, would be minimal in the state. If we're talking about shipping and trucking and this type of thing, we might be saving on the aluminum cost, but seems to me we would be using fuel and doing this, and it's minimal anyway. There's a study by the Commerce Department If anyone would care to get it, again, I haven't seen it, but it's the number's A-01-75, United States Department of Commerce Study on Energy, October 1975, found that the savings would be 0.15% if the bottles had a 90% return rate. And if the savings were only 70% or 7 out of 10 trips, there would be no energy saving. As I say, I think the Washington bill has a recyclable component in their law.
Any more questions of Mr. Lauber?
Thank you very much.
Someone else wish to testify?
Trying to recycle.
Haven't seen you since 1:30 last night.
I know, Fred. We've got to stop meeting like this. Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Virginia Dalpiez, and I'm representing the Alaska Conservation Society. This is Chris Foster, who represents the Alaska Public Interest Research Group. Our two groups have joined together in kind of a loose coalition because both of our boards feel that the bottle bill is a very high priority bill, both environmentally and for consumers. And first off, I'd like to just note that I think the committee's on the right track in the line of energy conservation, and I'm really glad to see this because this room must be about 55 degrees. So I think you really got the right setting here. And with that, what Chris and I are going to do is try and cover some of the arguments that haven't already been answered and do it as briefly as possible, because we do realize you have to go into session fairly shortly. And so what we're going to cover as many things as we can that we think have been left out by some of the other witnesses. First, I'd like to start off by kind of putting the bottle bill in a national context. Resource recovery is getting much emphasis nationally, especially in relation to the nation's energy shortage. Many states and municipalities have actively investigated waste disposal systems that serve a second purpose, that is the recovery of energy and other valuable resources. Scarcity of landfill sites, high cost of disposal, and rising energy and material prices encourage the adoption of resource recovery technologies, such as we're talking about here with the bottle bill. There have been several national pieces of legislation, the Solid Waste Disposal Act of 1965 and the amendments in 1970. These are administered through the Environmental Protection Agency, which has been the lead agency on this nationally. Both houses of Congress have considered major legislation on waste management during the past year, 1976. Discussions of solid waste on the national level have included proposals such as comprehensive planning at regional, state, and local levels, as well as product charge systems that would impose an excise tax on consumer packaging and paper for the cost of their disposal, such has been talked about with the Washington bill. The concept there is one of full cost pricing, which the prices reflect disposal costs of products as well as the manufacturer costs of producing them. Theoretically, the charge will discourage wasteful consumption and encourage the use of recycled materials. Now, also, I think the committee should be aware, and I think Mr. Miller brought this out earlier, that under this, the Solid Waste Act, the beverage container guidelines have been issued on a national level requiring a 5-cent deposit on all beer and soft drink containers sold at federal installations. And this will go into effect nationally fairly soon. So, but still realize that the issues go far beyond just controlling litter. They do include conservation of raw materials and energy and reduction in the cost of solid waste collection and disposal. There are currently 5 states in the nation that have a bottle bill: Oregon, Vermont, Maine, Michigan, and South Dakota. Oregon obviously is the pioneer in this field and has done the most work on this, plus they did have the first piece of legislation. Other states have modeled their bill after Oregon's. And I was really interested to see what Representative Miller gave to the committee this morning, that the Coors Company has drafted up a uniform state container legislation, and if he hasn't made this available to the committee, I'd be glad to let you have this copy. And this is an attempt by a major company to get some kind of uniformity in the bottle bills, because I think they do realize that the trend nationally is going towards some kind of bottle bill legislation. As I said, the National Congress is considering this quite seriously. There have been several bills in, and there's a good possibility there will be a national act within the next couple of years. So the trend nationally is definitely moving toward legislation aimed at reduction of litter, energy conservation, and conservation of material resources through reuse and recycling. Now, Chris is going to go into some of the other aspects of the bill, I believe, transportation.
Yes. I'm going to talk about the transportation aspects of this bill for Alaska, the question of consumer choice, and I have some samples here of some containers with non-detachable ends that I will show the committee and speak briefly about those. But first of all, I'd like to talk about the Model Litter Control Act, since that has gotten had a lot of testimony. I, like Mr. Lauber, confess to be unfamiliar with many of the fine points of the Act, so I will not make guesses as to whether there are recycling provisions. However, it seems to me that a tax on all manufactured consumable commodities is going to be passed on to the consuming public in one way or another somehow, and that there are going to be, if such legislation were considered in Alaska, there would be the dedicated fund problems. Also, this is another attempt by, as I see it, by industry to refuse to take any responsibility for the container problem, you know, the problem of waste recovery and how they package their materials. It's a let the state do it attitude, and I have observed during my time with this legislature that is usually not something that is viewed with much alacrity, is letting the state do it. Can you imagine how many state employees we would need to add to our payrolls to mount a comprehensive litter control campaign? Can you imagine how much you'd have to pay someone to go out in the winter and pick up trash along the highways? I think to malign the Oregon law and then to suggest that Alaska adopt a Washington law is kind of silly. Now, the energy, also there's no consumer discretion involved. With the deposit system, the consumer or anyone who is interested in recycling the materials can get the deposit back. It's more a return to individualism. The energy question that Mr. Lauber touched on, most of our barges and trucks that come up go back empty. The load ratio in Alaska is 10-1. That is, you know, for every 10 full containers that come up here, we ship one back. Now, I submit that to take those barges back, it uses up energy. They, just because one out of 10 is full doesn't mean they run back for free or use no gasoline. There are tariffs for return of these materials to Seattle. I believe that this tariff was stated on Friday, that FOSS Alaska Line has a rate of $124 per 10,000 pounds, and that Sealand has a tariff of $179 per 10,000 pounds. And testimony was given to the effect that was a profitable rate in the case of Rainier bottles, and some breakdowns were given on that, so I won't go in go into that. As far as consumer choice in the marketplace, studies in Oregon have shown that there was no reduction in consumer choice. I am not familiar with all the testimony that was given against the Oregon bill when it was being considered by the legislature, but I would guess that there were probably retailers who may have threatened to go out of business or stop carrying soft drinks and beer. But given Mr. Passantini's figures of the volume that beverages made up for his business, I would think that might be rather an empty threat. And as a matter of information, the beverage industry spends about $20 million a year lobbying against this type of legislation, and that's a pretty hefty sum of money. The provision of the bill that would call for the non-detachable ends, I don't know. I have a selection here of non-detachable openings that I will pass around to the committee members. Mr. Lauber made mention of one that did not have to be, in other words, you did not have to use your fingers to actually open it, and I believe that is the one he's mentioning. However, here are several more. The California has recently adopted a non-detachable provision in their law. So the manufacturers of cans are definitely faced with gearing up full production lines for this type of opening, because California is one of the most populous states in the nation, is certainly one of the major beer and soft drink markets. And I would reassure the members of the committee that this technology does exist and is being adopted industry-wide. Alcoa, let's see, Reynolds Aluminum is in the process of converting all of its production to the stay-on-tab, and I believe they are marked, and I believe that the stay-on-tab is on the table before you. So to quickly sum up, I would want the committee to be very aware that industry has spent a great deal of time and money opposing this legislation across the country, and that fallacious claims have been made in many instances, claims that were proven not to be true. A major lawsuit was mounted in Oregon and was against the bottle bill, and it was not won. The Oregon's bill was not found to be in violation of interstate commerce or restraint of trade or any of the matters that the suit was brought on.
I have a couple questions. We have to go to the House in about 10 minutes or so, but first of all, for Ms. Del Piaz, you've mentioned, other witnesses have mentioned the Coors bill, if you like. I suppose the theory behind the Coors bill is that that one brewery figures that this thing's the wave of the future, and it's easier on industry if the law is as uniform as possible across the states, since they do business in several different states. I don't know about this particular draft that they've come up with, but do you therefore think it would be helpful for us to look at the laws of Oregon and Maine and elsewhere, and to attempt to have something as uniform as possible with those laws? Would your organization see anything wrong with that? Do you see a problem,
sir,
with the Oregon or the Maine law?
I assume that the committee will have some kind of markup session with this bill, since many suggestions have been made. I do know that Representative Miller did consider all of these different pieces of legislation in drafting up Alaska's bill. So I believe to a large extent they have been considered. I did personally look at all of the bills I could find, and the Maine bill probably, the state of Maine's bill, probably has the biggest differences from the state of Alaska's bill as it stands now. But I think the committee would find it helpful to have a comparison.
I suppose that I wanted to ask Mr. Lauber a question about that, but he's gone. I have some notes here for a question for Ms. Foster, but I can't read my notes, so Mr. Parr.
Yeah, Mr. Bill Paz, you mentioned the savings, and you were the general goals, you know, one of which was a saving in energy. You just heard Mr. Lauber say that referred to the Department of Commerce study, which show that to be insignificant. Mm-hmm. So, do you think the study is wrong or inaccurate, or have you seen the study?
No,
or
sir, I haven't seen the study, and I was not clear on what he was referring to as being saved there. I didn't get whether it was bottles or what.
It was energy saving would be only what, 0.015.
Yeah, but he didn't say whether it was
something.
In recycling or reuse, or he didn't refer to in which area of energy savings it is.
Mr. Chairman, I hope we get a copy of that study.
I would think it would be useful.
And it ties in my second thing, which is to the other young lady here, and that is, she said something which we frequently hear, and which maybe we could get some more definitive statement on. And you said, studies in Oregon have shown that consumer choice is not restricted. But, you know, studies, it's too general. Do you have copies of the studies?
Yes.
Can you give us specific or references so we can get copies of them so we can look at them?
We have a great deal of information.
Yeah, it's just a thing, you know, somebody says,
yes.
It happens all the time, not just
right.
You.
Right, no.
Studies have shown that. You know,
right, we're kind of clipping along because things ran late, but both Ms. Del Piaz and I are here full time, and we stand ready to provide the committee
with
any information they desire.
Can you get that to staff here?
Certainly can.
Mr. Carpenter, were you finished, Charlie?
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Carpenter? Sam, what you're really trying to do, and tell me if I'm wrong, is to use legislation to cause or to deflect industry from throwaway marketing. That's what you're trying to do, isn't it?
Well, for a variety of reasons, you could draw that conclusion. There was, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I did go over the legal decision in Oregon in case there was a question. I did intend to go into it in some detail, but seeing as we have the time crunch, there is the part of the suit that talks about, Chris went into a little bit, the major thing that this was filed on, or the grounds for the suit, was three things: that the statute violated the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, that it violated due process and equal protection under the 14th Amendment, and then that it violated the provisions of the Oregon Constitution.
That's the old substantive due process argument, which industry used for the last 100 years. It was struck down by the United States Supreme Court in 1938, and industry still hasn't found it out yet.
That's right. Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Brown. You served. Whatever. But I will, since several have asked for more information, I did do a summary of the case, and since it was a fairly lengthy thing to wade through, I'd be glad to make that available to the committee so that you could see what happened in the legal challenge. And essentially what the Oregon court was saying was that the state is not compelled to attack all problems on everything, and that they can be selective, and they did rule that was consistent with the goals of the state for a clean, healthy environment and so forth and so on, and that this was not discriminating in particular against the beverage containers. It also based it also on the fact that it was not giving any undue advantage to in-state brewers or anything like this. It applied to everybody, and so that the interstate commerce clause was not violated. But it's a very interesting case, and I will make that available to the committee.
By the way, to be fair to the industry, they always plead in the alternative. That is usually the vital concern whenever we're addressing any kind of a thing that would constitute regulation of a particular area of industry that is in interstate commerce, because we always keep running into the supremacy clause of the United States Constitution. To what extent can we do it, and to what extent has Congress preempted that particular area? We went all the way through it with the tanker bill last year.
Mm-hmm.
It is a difficult problem, and that's not something that's been wished away by the Supreme Court a long time ago. Any further questions? We have about 6 minutes to get to the floor.
I've got a question. Mr. Keller, since he just walked back in.
Oh, okay, Mr. Hayes.
Got it.
I'm interested in the energy conservation aspects of the bill, and I'm wondering how we're going to handle the situation where the distributor sells directly to a retail outlet such as a bar. What's to prevent the, let's say the bar buys all of his supplies from one distributor. The distributor in that event wouldn't have to charge the bar owner any deposit. The bar owner simply just break the bottle and haul it out to the dump or smash the cans. And see, from the energy conservation viewpoint, that would defeat one purpose of this bill. Is there any solution to that?
Well, of course, number one, bear in mind that the total waste, if you're interested in the energy and the reclaiming of the thing, understand it's 100% waste right now. So anything we do is a great fast improvement. Under the terms of the bill, though, if the distributor is an Alaska-based distributor, for instance, an Anchorage distributor who supplies the bar, that distributor would charge the nickel and then give the nickel back when the bottles come back to it. So you would have the opportunity then for the, for the reclamation of the bottler.
What I'm saying is that he doesn't have to, because they can just simply reach a mutual agreement that...
he has to if the law says he does.
Okay. If that's what the bill says, I think that would cover my concern on that.
Meeting adjourned.
Mr. Chairman, if you'll look on, starting with the fourth paragraph, I think I covered very thoroughly on the energy consumption in my testimony.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right.
There's got to make some changes. I mean, I live in Colorado, and I have one.
Sitting in on the workman's comp drill or whatever that the council's going through.
That's right. They were ordered to attend.
So we'll take up Senate Bill 18 first. And are you going to be testifying for Senator Petula? Or?
Well, I've submitted written back of that bill there, Chairman.
She just sit and look at it, Mr. Chairman.
Who is much more, I'm sure Ms. Phillips is much more knowledgeable on the subject than I am, I'm sure. So do you have anything to offer?
Commissioner Mueller is out of town, so I thought that...
Why don't you come up to the table so we can pick you up on the mic?
Yes, I'm Dick Stokes with the Terrestrial Programs Division of our department, and in charge of the Solid Waste Management Program and also Pesticide Control. And I'm here mainly to answer questions, I think. We do support the committee substitute for Senate Bill 18.
Then the intent here is to provide a surety bond or liability insurance for the gun.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, in 1972 there were some fairly major amendments to the federal insecticide, the federal pesticide control laws, and this set up a system where the federal government would classify all pesticide products into two major categories: a general use category, which were pesticides that the untrained individual could use, and restricted use pesticides, which the assumption was that a person needed to be trained and proved competent to use these more dangerous ones. And as part of the federal law, there was a mechanism set up where a person could be certified as competent to use the dangerous types by a state agency. And he could be certified or licensed as either a commercial applicator or a private applicator. And the private applicator, for all practical purposes, is a farmer or a very serious home gardener, someone that uses pesticides on his own land to produce an agricultural commodity. And the federal law allowed different testing techniques for the private and the commercial person.
and allowed the state to set up a system where the private applicator or the farmer could be tested by less stringent mechanisms than the commercial guy. But the Alaska statutes that give us authority to regulate pesticide use in the state do not, with the present wording, allow us to make the distinction between the farmer and the commercial applicator. And the purpose of this bill, as we see it, is to remove the restriction and thus allow us, by regulation, to set up the two categories of applicator, the private and the commercial.
And it also allows you to require the bond for the commercial.
Right, right. And that is in the present statutes that we can require by regulation a surety bond or insurance.
This new language restricts it to
right.
Commercial. Are there any questions?
I have a question. When we say pesticides and broadcast chemicals, we're only talking about pesticides, I guess. But the broadcast chemicals are those that are used, for example, for clearing, for keeping vegetation down along a right-of-way, say a power line right-of-way or something.
The legal definition of pesticide includes insecticides and herbicides, and you're referring to herbicides.
Okay. So this is not, it's not just simply something that kills a little bug, it's also something that kills vegetation. So
right.
Forth.
Right.
And now, how about, well, for example, go back into the Fairbanks area, and Golden Valley runs these power lines out thing, which would they be considered private or custom, commercial, and contract? And if they want to go along and keep their power line right away, you know, keep that defoliate or whatever the hell you would call it, you know, to keep the trees and the stuff from getting up and draining the power line.
They would definitely be a commercial. Their applicators would fall into the commercial category.
Commercial doesn't mean you're doing it for pay from somebody else, in other words.
The commercial the commercial applicator, particularly, is seen by the federal legislation, and what we are adjusting to would include not only the contract sprayer, the professional exterminator, but also the agency applicators, such as the Department of Highways, roadside sprayers, Golden Valley right-of-way sprayers. Anyone who is not a farmer is classified as a commercial applicant.
Yeah, now, in the case of something like the, you know, the Golden Valley people, a co-op like this, would the department normally require them to furnish a surety bond or liability insurance?
It's not in the present regulations. The Commissioner Mueller has advised me that this is something that we should bring up in a series of public hearings we hope to have later this year, in promulgating new regulations so that we can to bring our regulations more in line with the federal requirements.
Well, now the bond, Mr. Chairman, I may continue, the bond or liability insurance, this is to protect somebody else who's, if the wind blows a spray over or somehow gets off from where it's supposed to go and it does something to somebody else's crops or property. This is to protect, to give that person the right of some way of recovering, is that right?
Right.
I know it, Mr. Chairman, in Fairbanks about 3 or 4 years ago, and I'm not sure exactly, but there was some big problem with some really nice birches, as I remember, in some stretch of land that apparently were all being killed under the birches. And the reason it was apparently some herbicide that used and been used for this very purpose, you know, right of way clearance. But the wind blew it over onto somebody's private property, and the guy was pretty unhappy about it, wanting to know where he got his where he got paid back, you know, for the loss of his trees and so forth. And so I assume that's the purpose of this liability insurance required.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, is there a definition that tells me the difference between quote unquote a restricted pesticide and a pesticide?
Well, the 1972 federal amendments define this on the federal level. They don't define it very clearly. They define a restricted use pesticide as one that is likely to cause adverse effects on the environment or public health unless controlled in some way. And that sets the stage for the federal government to actually do the classification into the two classes of chemicals. And we on the state level are staying out of that completely. This classification process it's been in process since about 1973, and originally was scheduled to be completed by October 1976. Congress extended the deadline for classification and for everything else until October 77, and at last reading, the Environmental Protection Agency, which is the federal agency that controls pesticides, is still not completed this classification task. And it may be some years before every chemical is classified one way or the other. They are behind schedule.
May I continue? If you may not have a copy of the bill in front of you, but I have this question. I have noticed that some places for abode in Juneau, both private and commercial, have cockroaches and silverfish. Now, if I read this rightly, you might, if I were to spray my home, you might require me to obtain a license. Do I read this correctly?
If I have one here, I'm sorry. It's possible, but very, very unlikely. If you were to spray cockroaches in your own home with one of these chemicals that was classified as a restricted use.
You just told me that the state is not getting into the classification business.
Right.
Okay, well, let's stay with that right now. We're not in the classification business.
Okay.
I'm going to spray some roach powder in the hall or in the kitchen of my house. Now, you may require me to be licensed to do that. If I read the bill correctly, do I read it correctly?
Yes.
Do you want a bill like that?
Well, we support a bill that would give, will allow us by regulation to require licensing if you intend to use the more dangerous pesticides.
Why don't we say that then?
Mr. Chairman?
But I'm not sure really how much further I can go on this.
Okay. Thank you.
Maybe I misunderstood something. As I read the bill, it's only if you're engaged in custom, commercial, or contract.
Well, that's why you eliminated.
That's been eliminated, see?
Wait a minute.
That's my concern.
We're talking about number 18?
Okay, line B. The department may provide by regulation for the licensing of persons engaged in the spraying or application of pesticides.
Oh, I see. I beg your pardon.
Broadcast
I'm sorry. They couldn't require you to have a bond or a liability insurance.
Right.
They could require you to have a license. Thank you. I missed the point there, Chairman. Well, I can, Mr. Chairman, I don't know. I happen to have a relative who's a farmer down in California. They have to have a very close supervision of any spraying that's used. And obviously, the reason is that the wind may blow this stuff onto the next guy's field. You're raising alfalfa, and he's raising something else. And what may be very good for alfalfa may kill his crops. And so they've been very, very, they've really got very tight controls on it, just for protection of the people next door, in a sense. I don't know. Maybe it's not necessary in Alaska if we don't have much agriculture at this point. I don't know. But, it is done now.
As I understand it, the licensing of a farmer is necessary in order for him to purchase the restricted chemicals under the federal law.
After October 1977. If without a change, the farmer could do Several other things. He could become certified as a custom commercial applicator, which requires a written examination, which is more stringent than what we intend to give the farmers. Or he could hire a person to do the spraying for him. Or he could forego the use of certain pesticides. And as I understand it, this bill would give him another option.
Any other questions?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think Ms. Chatham brought up a legitimate concern, you know, for the city people. However, I'm not sure that it's that we need to clarify in statute. But we might very well want to put a letter of intent in there saying, home use, now most of this roach and silverfish stuff, were you concerned about that in the context of these chemicals, or would it be just prepared stuff that you'd buy in Safeway?
That you buy in a store.
Yeah, maybe.
Or to spray your garden plants.
Yeah, just easily acceptable commercial plants. Stuff. Maybe we can put something like that in. What do you think?
Letter of intent?
Yeah, just a little letter saying, oh, look, don't go nuts on this thing.
Any regulations that did come out of this would be subject to our review.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to hear you ask a question about what apparently the general use things is nobody worries about much. It's restricted ones that are dangerous, right? What if we put in that line... at line 12 in front of the word pesticides and put in the word restricted. And I guess we could do it also in 913. We're not concerned with the general pesticides, just restricted, and the FDA or somebody is going to, EPA rather, is going to have decided which are restricted. And the department could license those people or require the bonds. How about maybe the witness could speak to that. Would that do violence to what's being intended here?
If I could say something else, Mr. Chairman, this would make it difficult for us to regulate the professional exterminator that might use these general use pesticides, but still come into a person's home to do his work or into a bar or a restaurant. And we would like, by regulation, to have more control on the professional exterminator type, the professional pesticide pest control operator, regardless of what pesticides he uses. But for the private applicator, the home gardener, the homeowner, the only ones we're worried about is the restricted type. And that will be done on the federal level regardless of our... regardless of what we do, each product that comes into the marketplace will be so labeled, and it will be illegal for a person to purchase the restricted use type, regardless of whether we implement the law or the federal government. That's it.
Chairman, if these general use ones are, it says in this letter here, if this is accurate, general use pesticides are those which are relatively safe for use by the general public. Now, if you do have a professional exterminator and that's what he's using, then why do you want to regulate him more closely? I mean, there's apparently no health danger if the general public can use him. I mean, I don't really follow your reasoning there. If we left it down to restricted pesticides, which are those that are too dangerous for untrained persons to use, the guy's going to come in your house and he's going to get rid of the roaches or the silverfish or whatever we happen to have using general use pesticides, which I could buy myself and use. Why do you want to be able to regulate it more closely? I don't follow you.
The feeling has been in the past, and it was expressed during public hearings we held in 73 to promulgate regulations, that there was an interest in more regulation of the guy that did it for hire than the private individual. And that's what the present regulations are based on, and our thinking was to extend this.
Mr. Chairman, sir, do you have the feeling that in, not necessarily your department, let's take another one, that in this public hearing process for the establishment following the Administrative Procedures Act, that the department is more apt to hear what they want to hear than to really hear what has been said by the people? I'm very suspect of the statement you just made. In other words, the public wanted this. That's what you wanted to hear. What is your comment on the public hearing process?
Well, I'm very hesitant to speak for the department on that question.
Speak to another department. Not yours.
You're talking about departments promulgating regulations for laws that were put on the books by the legislature?
I mean, you know, maybe here's the point.
That's an aside.
I mean, who gets up on a Saturday afternoon to come down and testify about pesticides that they want somebody who uses, you know, you know, sulfur or something, whatever, that you can buy at 50-pound lots to spray under some house to kill some little bug. I mean, who comes down and says, hey, we want more regulation on that on a Saturday afternoon or a Thursday evening? You see our problem?
I see your point.
Well, my problem is much more real, Mr. Chairman, if I can, is, and this involves your department. You have had some hearings on the Kenai Peninsula, and my cellmate, anyway, over there has gotten, his correspondence is replete with people saying that they went to the public hearings, made their statements, and you listened, but you did not hear what they said and went ahead with your regulations anyway, as you had proposed them.
The only regulations that I've been personally involved with has been the present pesticide control regulations.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean you personally.
I really.
The department. The department. Now, enough of that. I'm off the subject. I'm sorry.
Well,
I apologize.
I still don't see the point in not making this distinction between restricted and general use.
I question whether the letter is going to get anything in the regulation to do that. Letter of intent necessarily gets lost. And then two pieces of paper go different directions sometimes.
I was just bringing that up as a modifying factor so that we wouldn't necessarily have to substantively amend the, you know, or amend the bill.
The only letters of intent would mean the thing of those out of a free conference committee,
yeah,
usually. Or you can do what I did last year one time. I got on the floor of the House and had the House adopt what a certain intent right on the floor of the bill was being considered. Usually it's a free conference committee or the last committee to handle a bill in its final passage puts in one. But we do it and it goes to somebody else, you know, it doesn't mean a thing. Because, you know, how can a judge come back 10 years from now and say that our intent was the same one that the Senate had when they passed this thing or whatever.
Mr. Chairman, it's really Mr. Parr's suggested amendment that I've put out here, and I'm still not sure whether I'll vote for the bill, but I'll sure vote for an amendment like this. In line 12, you have application of, insert federally restricted. And in line 13, at the end of that line, of pesticides, between those two words, insert federally restricted.
What was the second?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any comment on that, Mr. Stokes?
I guess it will all come down to which specific products they classify as restricted. The current thinking is that a product such as the herbicide 2,4-D will not be restricted, and whether or not the committee might or might not wish for a person that applies, say, herbicides on a right-of-way or power line or highway right-of-way to be more closely covered or not. But again, it's difficult to say without knowing which particular products will be classified which way. In other words, with that wording in, it may be impossible for us to provide by regulation for the licensing of a Golden Valley Electric Association herbicide sprayer or a Department of Highway herbicide sprayer.
You mean, unless, you mean, what you're saying is they decide to use one that's not federally restricted, then you wouldn't have any basis.
And the present thinking is that the main one that they have used will not be restricted.
But if it's not restricted, it means it's not dangerous to the property alongside the right-of-way, right?
According to the Environmental Protection Agency.
Well, that's all we're interested in doing, really, is protecting people from this stuff spreading over and doing some damage, aren't we? Isn't that what we're looking at?
That's what we're trying to guard against.
Question.
Well, if we are going to adopt this, I think the better approach to take may be to eliminate federal and provide a definition for restricted.
Okay.
Terms are restricted under the 1972 federal insecticide.
I withdraw my motion in favor of yours.
Well, it's not mine. I'm amending yours. I intend to vote against your amendment. So.
Okay.
You know, let's offer as a substitute motion. The motion then is to add restricted in front of pesticide lines 12 and 13 and provide a definition for restricted. All those in favor of the motion, signify by raising your right hand. Those opposed, the motion carries. Excuse me?
Yeah, McKinnon and I opposed it.
Was you opposing your own motion?
No, it wasn't my motion. I was just correcting Mr. Chatterton's motion.
Oh, okay.
Are there any other amendments anybody is interested in making? In that case, I assume then that everybody's happy with the bill the way it stands now?
Pretty
substantive. Yeah, as a CS.
We'll move it when we get the CS.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, thank you for coming back. The other bill up this morning is...
wait a second. This is out of order, isn't it?
Yeah, I know it's a violation of the rules.
What happened?
It's a Republican bill.
Oh, my God.
Mr. Chairman, who passed out 383? I was drunk. I don't want to shake you up so early in the morning.
Really, hardly I do that.
I wanted to withdraw the motion simply to give Mr. Hayes and Chatterton a chance to,
speak on the merits.
Speak on the matter of fiscal responsibility and how we ought to be letting the banks handle these.
Well, we know you guys always vote for the governor's bill, so.
Do we have anyone here to testify?
Yes, we do. We don't have Mr. Urien, but We have the department here to.
Okay.
Mr. Urid had the wisdom to avoid showing up on this one. Why don't you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Pete Jeans, Director of Division of Business Loans. We're in favor of this legislation, and the main reason I'm here is to answer any questions that you might have on the business loan program. We tried to come up with there's several different cost indexes that are floating around the state. One of them that we went to was the Marshall Valuation Index that most of the appraisers use. And in the last 4 years, they come up with about a 27% increase in construction cost. Another one that we looked at was done by the Robert Snow Means Company. And according to their indexes, basic construction materials have risen about 29% nationwide since 73, and they also say that labor costs have risen about 40%. It's hard to tie these into actual increases in Alaska, but I think all of us have seen the prices increase, and I think that raising this limit to $50,000 is a reasonable amount. From what we've seen on basic building construction, it has gone up between 40 and 50% in the last 3 years.
I was hoping the department would be opposed so we'd have an excuse to kill Urian's bill. We're going to have to pass this up.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask Mr. Bradley a question? What percentage did we increase the veterans' loan?
That's what I was trying to.
Oh, that's what you're.
Well, I can't remember what the memos said, but we bumped it from 55 to 75. So what's the percentile bump there?
Almost 50%. Almost 50%. About 45%.
Yeah.
They're somewhat consistent.
Yeah.
we raised
the veterans. Business loan, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. But I don't think that was as big as of a percentage.
I mean, it was 100 to 125.
That seems right to me. 100. Yeah, 125.
Yeah,
so
that'd be
right. Now, Mr. Chairman, on the veterans loan, at first that was going up to 120, then it was changed to 125, and from what I understand now, there's going to be a committee recommendation for 150 to bring it in line with this one.
Oh, is that right?
That's what I've heard.
Oh, yeah, but they put it to a subcommittee, and I haven't got around to checking out. What have they done, if you can tell me?
Every day they come over and ask me for figures on this. On the commercial fishing program, it was raised to 150. Now the small business, they're talking about going to 150.
Okay,
on the veterans program, it's identical to our small business program, except you have to be a veteran. That's the only difference in the two programs. Yeah. So I feel that if one is 150, they both should be.
Yeah, right on. Okay. Do you know what they did with the housing? Are you familiar with that? I can find that out.
The department recommendation came in at
lower,
and it's bounced back and forth, and it seems like about a $10,000 spread that everybody is having problems with. So I don't know what the final figure is.
I have one question I'd like to ask you. What's our status of losses on this program? How's it doing in general, in other words?
Okay. On our delinquencies, it averages anywhere between 2 and 5% a month. And for the yearly average, it would come out about 2.5%. Here's a list that I did for one of the finance committees that lists all of our programs. This column is 15 to 45.
Right. Small business.
Small business is the top line.
3% delinquent this month.
And this is for March. This is this month's figures. We've had one write-off in the division. That was in the small business program, and it was $3,000. We
that was in 73. We had a foreclosure of the law. Awesome. That's the only write-off we've had on the program.
How's the 2 point, how does that compare with commercial track record?
We've tried to get those figures from the banks, and they lump everything together. We haven't been able to get a breakdown from the banks on just the commercial loans. They lump their installment loans, commercial loans, home loans, everything together. And the bankers that I've talked to said that it's a good percentage, but what they're getting, I really don't know.
Any other?
I reinstate my motion.
Oh, I suppose you might as well.
Well, you're the one.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if the committee would like to keep this status report, I'll leave this here with the committee. But it has all of the loan programs listed on it.
How's the veterans? Is the veterans just as good as the other ones, better or worse?
Well, in our programs, we have a late penalty after 15 days. So anything over 15 days, we call delinquent. They use 30 days.
Oh, veterans.
Veterans does. So the percentage would be quite different using the 30 days. I think they come up with about 2%. So it's improved considerably over last year.
Thank you for coming back. We also have our CS on the.
Brings in more motherhoods. I mean, we can give them all.
It's just so rare that you see a Republican willing to give away money that we figured we'd.
I know. I'm a little skeptical. Remember that one that Brad and Tom just came to? What was it?
Raising the interest rate.
The interest rates.
This is.
I never could figure that out, but I always figured, well, Brad was in something.
What were the changes we made in that?
What, pest site?
No, the alcoholic beverages notice thing.
Okay. I thought we just took Steve Cooper's bill, didn't we?
Yeah, we took House Bill 180, there, I believe.
Yeah.
We've got a CS back, so we must have made some change in it.
Well, you had a draft of CS for us, and we didn't buy it.
Yeah, I know, but this is a CS for application year.
Well, basically, 180 is something to it.
No, we didn't do anything to it.
Yeah, that's right.
Is it
okay?
That's right.
The chairman
would have known. Yeah,
that's right.
We got a CS back with identical language. Maybe we ought to send that out and
what number
see if anybody notices.
It isn't 180,
is it? Yeah. CS for 180, identical language, the original bill.
180.
We got back a CS for 180 that's identical to the original.
That's the only change.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. You did that.
Okay, we do have a CS.
Yeah.
Yeah.